Good evening, everybody. It's great to see you all here tonight. I'm Sarah George. I'm the Executive Director of the Natural History Museum of Utah, and I want to welcome you to the final and keynote lecture of our 2019 lecture series, Ancient Secrets, Hidden Worlds Revealed. The desire to seek truth and discover answers to the unknown is as old as humankind. This year, we invited four remarkable individuals to share their stories and their research with you. These intrepid explorers have traveled the globe and used the latest technologies in search of knowledge about long-ago cultures, civilizations, and our ancient ancestors. I want to thank a number of sponsors and partners who made it possible for the museum to host this series each year. We're particularly grateful to the R. Harold Burton Foundation, our founding underwriter, and our underwriter, the Cultural Vision Fund, for their tremendous and ongoing support of this series. We'd like to thank our gold sponsor, Rio Tinto Kennecott, and our silver sponsors, the Clark Foundation, the Kent C. and Martha H. DiFiore Family Foundation, the M. Lazy M. Foundation, and Myriad Genetics. And then I'd like to acknowledge our media partner, KCPW 88.3 FM, and our community partners, the Benning Society at the University of Utah School of Medicine, the Salt Lake City Downtown Library, our official airline, Delta and Aeromexico, Kingsbury Hall, Liberty Heights Fresh, and the Salt Lake County Library Viridian Event Center. And then finally, I have to thank the voters of Salt Lake County, I think most of you here. Your approval of the Zoo Arts and Parks Fund provides incredible support for this series, for many, many other museum programs, as well as many additional cultural opportunities throughout Salt Lake County. So please join me in thanking these wonderful partners and supporters. So, I get to introduce tonight's speaker, space archaeologist and winner of the $1 million 2016 TED Prize, Sarah Parkak is the founding director of the Laboratory for Global Observation at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, where she's an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology. Inspired by her grandfather, who was an early pioneer of aerial photography, Parkak took an interest in remote sensing while she was studying Egyptology at Yale. Using infrared imagery collected from far above the Earth's surface, she's able to identify plant growth variations and locate long-lost remnants of human history. Employing these methods, her team has uncovered 17 potential pyramids, as well as thousands of lost settlements and tombs around the world. With her TED Prize money, Parkak is developing Global Explorer, an online application that allows people across the globe to search out lost civilizations from their homes and their classrooms. Please join me in welcoming Sarah Parkak.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you so much. So when I was thinking about how I wanted to start my lecture, I knew this would be a really special audience. And something truly extraordinary happened to me last night that is going to sound a little bit unbelievable to you. But I promise you it happened. So some of you know already what I'm about to say. So I'm on the airplane, and I land and turn on my phone, and I noticed that there were many, many messages from friends, some of whom I hadn't seen in a really, really long time. There we go. So I was a Jeopardy question last night. And in case you were wondering, it was Double Jeopardy for $400, and the category was archaeology. So this got me to thinking, you know, how could I possibly start this lecture? And then I remembered a story from years and years ago that I have never, ever shared publicly. So I thought that this Jeopardy question was a wonderful introduction, or invitation rather, for me to share this story with you. So this story starts in the summer of 2013 at the National Geographic Society. At the time, I had just been inducted as a fellow, and it was the 125th anniversary of the Society. So there was this enormous gala event, huge, at a big Smithsonian building, a huge party. All these amazing explorers had been invited from around the world. People like E.O. Wilson were being honored, Jane Goodall, and of course, Alex Trebek himself, because for years and years, he had led and asked questions of the National Geography Bee. Well, of course, all of us explorers were so excited. Alex Trebek was close to us. Maybe one of us would get the chance to see him or meet him, and it was this total buzz that was going around. Of course, you know, he would never be seen in the company of explorers such as us. So we just hoped that maybe we would get a glimpse. So a friend of mine, a complete troublemaker and a dear friend, kind of pulled me aside and said, "Hey, Alex is upstairs right now. You want to go meet him?" And I said to my friend, his name is Fred, I said, "Fred, like, come on, he's meeting with some, you know, senior executive vice president. There's no way that we can just go bust in on the meeting." And he said, yes, we can. So upstairs we went. So we go upstairs, and I said to Fred, "I assume you know him." And Fred goes, "No, I never met the guy in my life. But, you know, why can't we just go say hi to him?" So we open the door into this meeting that he is having with a top brass person at the Society, who I assure you was not amused that we had interrupted their meeting. And my friend Fred says, "Alex, there's someone amazing you have to meet." Like they were long lost friends. And Alex, of course, looks very amused. And he says, "Well, who do we have here?" And my friend says, "Well, meet Sarah Parkak. She's a space archaeologist." And Alex says, "Space archaeologist? That sounds really cool. What's a space archaeologist?" And my friend proceeded to say, "Well, it's, you know, Sarah looks at satellite images and she processes them using different parts of the light spectrum and she finds all these amazing sites. You know, she's been working in Egypt for 15 years. Well, at that point, Alex gets a wicked gleam in his eye and he stands up and proceeds to move in front of this map that I have right here. It's a National Geographic map of the world. And he assumes Alex Trebek position and says, "I know you have worked in Egypt, but have you worked in," and he moves his arms around and around and around, and he points, "Tunisia." And I said, "Well, Alex, I'm so glad you asked, because a couple years ago, I collaborated with this amazing team, and we used very high-resolution satellite imagery in Tunisia to map Roman period roads, and we found all of these amazing forts and this Roman road system that just went on and on and on. Yeah, it was a great collaboration." Kind of looked at me a little bit, finally goes, "This, okay, that was luck. That was luck." So he says, "Okay, I know you have worked in Egypt and Tunisia, but have you worked in," again, he moved his arms around, "Italy?" I said, "Well, I'm so glad you asked." So, I collaborated with this amazing team at Southampton University, Professor Simon Key and his team, and they work at the site that's just south of Rome's Fiumicino Airport, which you can see in the upper left-hand part of the image. And so the Emperor Claudius started the site, and it was expanded upon by the Emperor Trajan in 118 AD, and there's this amazing hexagonal basin. And what the site was, it was essentially the Amazon.com of ancient Rome. You know, people would sail in from all over the Roman Empire with their goods. They'd be unloaded at the warehouses of Portus, and they'd sail up the Tiber River to be distributed to the wealthy individuals of Rome. And, you know, while we were there, the team had never before used very high-resolution satellite imagery. And Simon and his team, for a very long time, had been searching for the amphitheater of the site of Portus. This is a major trading site. You have warehouses, you have roads, you have marble mining. You know, it was a really thriving site. So of course you would have had a place where people would have been entertained. And so we got very high resolution satellite imagery. So here are the fields that are a little bit to the east of the main basin at Portus, and we processed it. And lo and behold, this amazing site shows up. It's about 40 meters wide with 8-meter thick walls, east-west roads. You can see the circle right in the feature, right there, and that indeed is, you know, was an amphitheater. And he's looking at me. He goes, "I am going to get you in this one." So he looks. He looks at the map very carefully, and he looks at me. He goes, "I know you've worked in Egypt, and I know you've worked in Tunisia, and I know you've worked in Italy, but have you worked in Romania?" And he stared at me, and his eyes got big, and he's just, "I got you." I said, "Well, you know, it's amazing, because it's an extraordinary country, and it has the richest history." And yeah, so last year, I worked with a team at Clu“ University, and we, you know, processed imagery at this amazing site called Sirmis Aegutia Regia. It was a Dacian capital of ancient Rome, and actually the Emperor Trajan, you just heard about it, Portus, went there because he was really interested in the silver and silver and lead mines. And so here's part of the city, and we used this incredible new technology called LIDAR, which stands for light detection and ranging. And, you know, what it does is it sends down millions upon millions of pulse beams of light, and it allows you to strip away overlaying vegetation to find what's beneath. And the challenge we had with Sirmis Aegutia Regia is that it's primarily beneath the trees. So this is what the site looks like before. So the central part, what you see there, is what you just saw kind of exposed. It's an open clearing, but the rest of the site is under the forest. So that's the after. And what you see here, so here's the central part of the site that's exposed, and what you see there is it's a classic Roman ditch and fortification system. And you can kind of see around it, there's some little notches in it, and that's where archaeologists had worked previously, but you literally couldn't see the forest for the trees because everything was obscured. At this point, Alex is looking at me. He says, "I give up. You win." Now, this sounds like a truly unbelievable story, something that someone like me might make up, but I humbly offer you this next photo as proof. So he very, very happily posed with me for that photo. I'm sure he has dined out on that story as well. So that's a slight introduction to space archaeology. And as Sarah mentioned in her lovely introduction, the reason I do what I do is because of my grandfather, Harold Young. He was a forestry professor at the University of Maine in Orono. And he was one of the pioneers in using aerial photography in forestry. So we were very lucky when my brother and I were younger to be able to spend a lot of time with my grandfather and my grandmother. Grampy was a World War II hero. He was a captain in the 101st Screaming Eagles. He jumped the day before D-Day, Bronze Star with a cluster, Purple Heart, total legend of a human being. But this is Grampy looking at his stereoscope at the University of Maine Department of Forestry in the 1950s and 1960s. And so I grew up hearing stories about my grandfather using this quote-unquote new technology. And he's the reason I took my first remote sensing course as an undergraduate at Yale. So unfortunately, my grandfather passed away after my first year as an undergrad. But I really feel like, you know, when I do my work, my grandfather is very much still with me. So this field is fundamentally transforming the entirety of archaeology. I tell people it's a golden age of discovery right now, between the use of satellite imagery, drones, lasers, underwater sensors, DNA, dating techniques, new discoveries. It seems like every week that we see an extraordinary discovery announced from somewhere in the world. So what you see in front of you, this is very high resolution satellite imagery. So the technology is so good now that you can zoom in from 400 miles in space and see things as small as 11 inches. It's amazing. And when you look just at how much the technology has improved, you know, 40 years ago the resolution was 60 to 80 meters. And then 25 years ago it was 30 meters. And then 20 years ago, it got down to 1 to 5 meters, and then 0.6 meters, 0.5 meters, 0.3 meters. And in a couple years, I am certain that we're going to have 0.1 meter resolution. That's just a couple inches. So what does that allow us to see? Well, as of right now, you can see the outlines of entire cities from space. This is a Roman period city that's in the Egyptian Nile Delta. Let's zoom in a little bit. You can clearly see all the roads, all the individual houses. And what this technology allows us to do in places like Egypt and Syria and Iran and across the Middle East and North Africa is be able to make inferences about these extraordinary places and cultures long before we go into the field. As you all know, we're all struggling right now with funding, with not as much time in the field, with getting permits, and we have to be able to pinpoint with laser accuracy exactly where to go and what to do prior to any excavation season, because of course we want to maximize our time in the field. And what this allows us to do is say things like, okay, I'm interested in a middle class Roman period housing, and I'm interested over the course of this season in looking at the relationships between domestic space and public space. Well, lo and behold, you have all these sites, you have all these houses, and you can pick out specific houses to excavate before you go into the field. That is the amazing leap forward we've had in technology. And don't take my word for it, my colleagues are using this data all over the world, from reimagining our ideas and concepts of Angkor Wat and the collapse of the Khmer civilization to finding hundreds and hundreds of previously unknown sites across the Middle East, completely reimagining our idea of Stonehenge. And this amazing discovery, which you may have heard a little bit about last year, my colleagues at the working in collaboration with the Panacum Initiative at Tulane University used the same laser technology that we used at in Romania, LIDAR, to find over 60,000 previously unknown features at the site of Tikal alone in Guatemala. And I'm not sure if any of you have had the chance to see the absolutely world-class Maya exhibit that's currently at the museum, but I really encourage you to go. I had the chance to go today. And the idea that this data has uncovered tens of thousands of previously unknown sites, and it's going to allow us to map for the first time the entirety of an ancient civilization that's currently obscured by millions of square kilometers of rainforest. Think about all that data. Think about all the amazing new insights that we are going to get into the Maya civilization. And that's just one civilization of hundreds across the globe. So what's at stake? We have all these amazing discoveries. We're understanding why it's so important. Well, for me, as an archaeologist, I'm always trying to answer the question of why. And so what? Why should we care about the past? Why does that matter today? And I think for me, I am most passionate about the idea that we come from the same people, that we have not evolved as humans, our technologies have evolved, but really we haven't, in hundreds of thousands of years. And what archaeology allows us to do is to bridge that vast gap between us and the past. One of my favorite stories to share is, did you know that in ancient Mesopotamia there were mother-in-law jokes? I mean, nothing's changed that much, really, in thousands of years. I could give you many examples like that. That's just one. But it kind of makes us stop and think, wow, like, we're not all that different. People may have different backgrounds and faiths and perspectives and speak different languages, but there are so many truisms about our humanity. And to me, in these fractured times across the globe, when we're contending with so many enormous issues, regardless of your political beliefs, issues of climate change, migration, terrorism, population growth, disease, all these issues are not new. They've been going on ever since we've been human. And what archaeology allows us to do is bridge those gaps and find our common humanity and build bridges. Because right now, more than ever, I think we need to build bridges. Thank you. So there's a lot that's at stake as well, globally. I am sure all of you heard about the terrible things that ISIL did in Syria and Iraq following the Arab Spring and the revolutions. So many hundreds, if not thousands, of archaeological sites in the Middle East have been looted. Now, looting is just one of a vast array of issues and challenges we're facing with protecting our shared global heritage. Of course, development across the world as populations increase, as people need new houses, development, tourism, so many archaeological sites are threatened. You not only have looting, but even with things like climate change and bulldozing of vast tracts of rainforest in places like Brazil or Central America, many, many archaeological sites have been destroyed. You know, in the recent government shutdown, the archaeological community got up in arms because on a number of online boards, there were messages like, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, hey everyone, sites like Gettysburg are no longer guarded, let's get our metal detecting units out and let's go loot them. Huge problem all over the world. You know, what can we do? Well, you know, before 2011, before the Arab Spring, I was far more focused on using satellite imagery to map sites, mainly in Egypt at that point. Did a little bit of work in the Roman Empire. But my eye was not on looting. And then the Arab Spring started in late January 2011. It's hard to believe that 8 years have passed. And so National Geographic had reached out to me and they said, look, like we hear rumors of looting that's going on in Egypt, but do you think if you got some new satellite imagery, you could prove one way or the other that there's looting going on? And I said, well, sure. I have tons of imagery from 2009 to 2010. I'm sure if there's any evidence of looting, we'll find it. And unfortunately, looking at satellite imagery from 2011 to 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, we see not many looting pits, to many, many hundreds of looting pits across Egypt. So my team that I work with, I work with an extraordinary team of people. We decided that it was time to really look at the satellite imagery across Egypt. So we looked at Google Earth imagery. We got amazing high resolution imagery from a company in Colorado called Digital Globe. And we essentially processed all this imagery from 2002 all the way up to 2014. It was not a very happy time for us. Everywhere we went, everywhere we looked, you saw looting pits. And you can see a looting pit is typically a dark oval covered with surrounded by dirt. So we mapped not only the number, but the size. And this is just one archaeological site in the Egyptian Delta. There are over 1,000 looting pits that are there. So you may be asking yourself, well, who would do this? Why would people seek to loot or destroy sites? Who does this? It's a really complicated question. People loot for different reasons. Sometimes you have organizations like ISIL that are just, they're just bent on destruction for the sake of destruction. They know what they're doing is evil and they don't care. Sometimes you have situations where people and communities live next to or by archaeological sites. And for them, the archaeological sites are like piggy banks. They work in essentially a gig economy and they can tap the site and go loot a tomb and then they have money to pay their children's school fees. What would we do if we were in the same situation? We can't judge so easily. Well, if it's not necessarily the fault of the people that live near sites who are, to a large extent, struggling to get by, who do we blame? And here's the analogy I'd like to share with you. I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan. And if you think about Gollum, all Gollum wants is the precious. That's it. That's his MO. He just wants to hold it and own it and hide it away forever. And for so many people, for so many collectors, they want the precious. They want these beautiful objects. Part of me doesn't blame them. It's one of the reasons I love archaeology and excavation. But I would challenge any donors or people who like to buy objects, think of it this way instead. Instead of owning a piece of history, why not instead donate to archaeological projects so that you can own the idea of creating history, because you own that when you support it. So we're trying to change minds and change hearts. So I want to tell you a little bit about how this work led me to my current project work in Egypt. I'm so excited to be able to share with you some of our latest, very exciting results. So I co-direct a project at a site called Lisht. It's located about 2 hours south of Cairo. It dates to Egypt's Middle Kingdom, so this is about 3,800 years ago. And the site is extraordinary. So after the first intermediate period, two kings, Sinwasrit I and Amenemhat I, so Sinwasrit was the son of Amenemhat I, they moved to this region of Egypt, kind of very, very strategically located near the apex of, just south of the apex of the Nile. And they set up a new capital called Ich-Tawi, or the two lands. And what they did, because of course with a thriving city, they built this amazing capital. And at this capital, you had ships coming in from Aswan with beautiful stones for them to make statues. You had ships coming in with trade goods from Byblos, so all of this amazing, all this amazing cedarwood to make boats to help with construction. Trade was coming in from all over Egypt. And what Amenemhat I and Sinwasrit I did is they supported a whole network of scribes and craftsmen and tradespeople. Well, if you have all of these hundreds, if not thousands upon thousands of people working and living in your court, of course they're going to want to be buried near you. And that's what you have here. You have a massive necropolis. So the image that's sort of whitish and on the bottom with all the lines coming off of it, this is the pyramid of Sinwasrit I at the site today. And unfortunately, what you see all around it, the red dots and the yellow dots, are hundreds and hundreds of looting pits. This was one of the sites that was one of the worst looted after the Arab Spring. So it kind of drew my eye there. I thought, well, it's a site that's always fascinated me, and it's a place I really want to go to check out. So with the kind permission of the Ministry of Antiquities, I got to visit in the summer of 2015, and I wondered, okay, are they really looting pits? You know, are we really mapping all of these thousands of looting pits at this site and across Egypt? And we found looting at almost 300 sites, and we mapped over 200,000 looting pits. So we had to check for ourselves to see what was there. And unfortunately, what you see in front of you is indeed a looting pit. So you can see the brick that's sticking out in this shaft tomb. So essentially, think of it almost like a reverse mausoleum that you would see in a place like New Orleans. So you have this deep shaft, and you have different cemeteries that are, or different burial shafts that are running off of it. And so these would have been family graves. This originally would have been covered by a mud brick mastaba, which is Arabic for bench. So this was actually a sealed tomb. This tomb was intact when the looters attacked it. What would have been in it? A standard middle class, upper middle class Egyptian tomb would have had one or more beautiful coffins. And by the way, this is just in one of the tomb chambers. Typically, these shafts have between 6 and 12 of these chambers. So one or more beautiful sarcophagi, boat models, 3D models of houses, statues made of wood or bronze, beautiful shabtis, boxes filled with jewelry, linens, perfumes, unguents, and on and on and on. Multiply that times 6 to 12 per tomb, then multiply that by 1,000, because that's how many shafts we found. It's pretty sobering when you think about it. It's enough to fill museums the world over. So we thought, what can you possibly do? What can you possibly do in the face of so much destruction? What hope can there be at this site, or indeed any sites that have been looted? So my colleagues at the ministry brought my attention to this one tomb. They said, look, the tomb's been really heavily looted. I don't think we're going to find anything, but please, do you think you could do a little bit of work there with us? So I should mention my mission's a joint mission, so that means that I have an Egyptian co-director. There are equal numbers of Egyptian and foreign participants. That's really important to me as someone who believes in broadening platforms and making more opportunities available for archaeologists in the countries where we work. So this is a tomb. So it may not look like much, but you see there's a niche that's off to this side. So there are three niches. This tomb would have originally been roofed. So it's called a classic T-shaped tomb. So we've just started our season. I'm with two of my directors right there. And you can see here there's an entranceway, and it's a T-shaped tomb because that's its shape. Like I said, it originally would have had a roof. Over time, it's been quarried away. There would have been three niches in the back, and within the hallway, which is where all of my Egyptian workforce is working, there would have been 2 to 4 shaft tombs. So that's where the owner of the tomb and his family would have been buried. So we're working, we're really not finding much. We're finding lots of modern garbage. I'm thinking, gosh, this is terrible. Like, what are we possibly going to find? But the one thing I've learned in archaeology is you can never expect what you're going to find tomorrow. So we had this incredibly magical day on site one day. So this was in 2015. Off to your left is the name of the tomb owner, Intef. So we started finding his name. We started finding titles. This is the quality of the art that we're able to find on the site. So the Middle Kingdom was ancient Egypt's Renaissance period. It was its high period of art and architecture and literature. And if any of you have learned or are interested in learning Middle Egyptian, this is the period of time that you study. There are amazing poems and extraordinary stories and tales of daring from this time. And as I said, the two kings, Amenemhat I and Senwasser I, supported this amazing community of craftsmen. And this is the quality of what they were able to produce, this beautiful, lifelike portraiture. And this painting looks like it was painted yesterday. It's 3,800 years old. And this is what it looks like moments after it's pulled out of the ground. So we're very lucky as we continue to excavate, we started finding in situ stones. That means stones that were in place that looters did not touch. So here you see the name of one of the owners, a tomb owner's son, Senwasret. We see his name, Intef Mes Ippi. So Intef, born of Ippi, the justified. So Ippi was actually his mother. This is pretty, not completely rare, but not that usual, not that normal. So indeed, powerful women were revered in ancient Egypt. And Intef, in this case, is honoring his mother by putting her name there. And you can see that his sons are carrying bows and arrows. So as it turns out, Intef was the overseer of the army. He was the chief general. He was the sole companion of the king. He oversaw the treasury. So think of him as like a combo chairman, joint chiefs of staff, and secretary of the treasury. He was a really, really important guy and very, very close to the king. And this makes sense because when you look at the position of his tomb, it's located right next to the causeway of the pyramid of Senwasret I. This is totally prime real estate. He was a really important guy. So at the end of the season, we very carefully sealed up all the shafts, or all of the tomb entrances with reinforced metal to make sure that the looters couldn't possibly attack it again. But it's not just about satellite imagery for me. That's kind of the route in, and this is about uncovering lost worlds and uncovering the past. So what we do in the field is we use innovative technologies like differential GPS mapping. So my two team members, Chase and Molly, and what they're doing with this differential GPS is they're going out and they're taking thousands upon thousands of points to be able to recreate the tomb in 3D. And this is what you end up with. So you first end up with thousands of polygons. You can see where we've excavated in the hallway. But then we start to add texture. And you really get a sense of what the tomb would have looked like thousands of years ago. This is really important for what we do in archaeology. So we went back in 2016. We found this amazing little Sekhmet goddess. We worked more in the entranceway. But for me, the best part of that season was running a field school. So I had the great fortune of being able to train seven really extraordinary, bright, talented young men and women who are young archaeologists working as part of the Ministry of Antiquities. They learned about archaeological survey, excavation, cultural heritage, mapping, geology. And I'm really, really passionate about making sure that we train the next generation of archaeologists and scientists. So I'm very excited that we'll be going back in future seasons and running more field schools. So there was a lot at stake when we went back for our last season in 2017. We had to finish more or less excavation in the tomb. We had a lot of conservation work to do because when we dig in Egypt, it's not just about digging and discovering. It's about protecting and preserving the tomb to make sure that it can either be open for tourism down the road or potentially worked on more in future. So, by the way, the landscape that we work in is gorgeous. The desert edge sharply ends right at the lush Nile Valley plain, and these, it's almost like a neon emerald green that you see in front of you every day when you dig, and we're working next to a modern cemetery as well, so it's this amazing confluence of the old and the new. It's a very sacred space, and it's just a huge honor to work there. So this is the tomb as we're excavating, so you can see up the entranceway into the hallway, everything's been bricked up. You see Chase with his differential GPS working away. And then we had this amazing moment towards the middle of the season because the question all along had been, where is Intef buried. Where could he possibly be? So I work with this amazing group of Egyptians, both from the village of Lisht and from a village called Guft, where men in the village have been working with archaeologists, foreign archaeologists, for 150 years. So you see my amazing Rice, my overseer, my dear friend Omer. He's wearing the blue vest and the turban and the white short shirt. And you see him looking at a stone, and he's telling the team to move it. And when he moved that stone, we saw a gap going into the ground. It was one of the most exciting moments of my career. So we're going to skip ahead a bit, because that's what it looked like when we were digging, and that's what it looked like at the end of the season. And you can see the tomb with the grate on top of it. That is the tomb of Intef. We have to go back in future seasons. We didn't quite have enough time. That always happens in archaeology. But you can see just how many shafts there are. We can count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And that's just in the main entrance and hallway of this tomb. There are undoubtedly more, for sure. So we started doing conservation work. But over the course of that season, we were so lucky, because there'd been so much looting, but the looters had missed something. They had missed a massive area at the bottom of the tomb that still had original tomb debris. And we started finding things like this. Beautiful faces. This is a face of moments after it was taken out of the ground. Now, of course, we don't just pull things out of the ground. We record them in situ. We take their picture. But this is just as it's being taken out of the ground. It's going to be bagged and tagged and sent to our conservation and recording team. We found images like this, images of beautiful vegetables and fruits from offering scenes from the tomb. So these are part of the original tomb wall that collapsed over time. We discovered intact pottery. So these are offering vessels, so you would put an altar on top of the one vessel in the back and make offerings. Beautiful bowls where people could come and make offerings of mead and beer and other things for the deceased. So think of it almost like an ongoing Day of the Dead. We had a little challenge, both in the tomb of Intef, and this is another shaft tomb that we found. About 5.5 meters down, we hit water. This is very common. The water table in Egypt has risen over time. It's very dangerous for our work crew. The safety of our work crew is the most important thing for us. So we stop it. We'll go back in future seasons, and we'll excavate with a pump. This is done quite normally. So that's our wonderful local work staff, and we're preparing mud bricks because, as I said before, the most important thing in addition to excavation is conservation. So we're preparing these bricks to conserve the original mud brick causeway of the tomb. And I absolutely love this photo. This is one of our wonderful young workmen, a Gufti, Ahmed, and he's completely posing for that picture. He knows he's fantastic. So we had a big announcement last fall that the ministry very kindly announced that we discovered over 800 tombs in the southern part of Lisht. We still have to go back and do more mapping in the north. But what this tells us, in spite of so many of these tombs being looted, what it tells us is so much about the mortuary architecture of the Middle Kingdom. It allows us to make insights into things like class, things like who was buried where and in relationship to what. So in spite of there being so much looting, there's a wealth of information that we can get about these tombs, of course, and about places that have been looted more broadly. So I want to get back to kind of the so what. What's at stake? No big deal, just the some knowledge of who we are and where we've come from and the potential for our future existence on planet Earth. A lot is at stake. So, you know, I got to thinking, you know, what could we do in the face of so much looting and destruction and loss? What can we do to protect the past? And in so many of these instances, in so many of the places I've been fortunate enough to travel in the world, you know, the biggest challenge is that people don't feel like they're the ones that are telling our story. You know, people say, oh, it's archaeologists in the ivory tower. It's the foreigners that come and work here. But the reality is, if you'll excuse the analogy, we need to invert the pyramid of discovery. We need to make sure that everyone around the world is playing a part in discovering, in helping to move archaeology forward. Because the reality is, we as an archaeologist and Egyptologist and those of us that do remote sensing, we can't do it by ourselves anymore. There's too much to find, there's too much to map, there's too much to protect. And for me, you know, when I was able to make my wish at TED a couple years ago, I wanted to create this global army, not a, you know, no small thing, that could really come together and be empowered to help protect and preserve the past. You know, this is not something that we're going to fix in a year or two, but the next generation, I think we have a chance at helping them to understand that the past is worth saving. So this is why I founded Global Explorer. I give our website here. That's our user account. So it's an online citizen science platform that allows anyone in the world to look at satellite imagery. I sort of, when we announced the platform, I joked, you know, it's for people between 5 and 105, kids of all ages. It's completely free, doesn't cost anything. So Global Explorer is a not-for-profit based in Birmingham. We're a staff of about seven people. You know, we want to make sure that the world can explore and find sites. We decided to launch in Peru for many reasons. The Ministry of Culture there has a long and rich history of using technology, of using drones. A lot of the country is exposed, it's desert, it's open, so it's easy to use satellites. And we wanted to make sure that what we did was completely transparent and obvious to the world. So instead of really hiding, we wanted to make sure people knew how many people were on the platform, how many people were looking at images, and also how many things were we finding. And this is a very early image from early days of the site. We had really amazing ground partners. We were able to partner with a group called the Sustainable Preservation Initiative. They're an organization that exists in Peru, and they work in other countries as well. And what they do is they empower women living next to and on top of archaeological sites and gives them new business opportunities so that they can gain economic freedom for their families. I'm working with Dr. Larry Coben right there, who's the founder of SPA. He's a very, very dear friend. And so these are the women of Pachacamac. If any of you have ever had the chance to go to Lima, this is an amazing archaeological site, an amazing Inca site. So this is about 1,000 years old. That's just outside Lima. And these are amazing women from the town that's just next to the site of Pachacamac. And they've been taught how to do local handicrafts. They weave, they make t-shirts, they make beautiful toys. And all of them sell their handicrafts to tourists. Unless you think that these women do not know what they're doing. They've got their iPhones and they're tracking sales and over time and return on investment. Like, these are amazing economists. They know more about money management than I do. And it was such it's been such a pleasure to be able to work with them. And so in the last year, we've been able to partner with SPI, and in addition to working with the women of Pachacamac, we've set up a tour called Visa Tours. It's a big tour path that people can take around the site. It's led by local villagers so that people can get on their bikes and visit the site, which is absolutely massive. So we really, for us, we as an organization, we see ourselves as using data and giving it to ministries, but also empowering the people that live onto or next to sites and letting them be the custodians and caretakers. So it's a pretty easy site. If any of you have been on it, I welcome you to. You just log in, and within a couple minutes, you're on the platform. You take a simple tutorial. And we wanted to make sure, you know, so many citizen science platforms, they're great, but you're on, and then you've got to take tutorials and more tutorials, and they're hard to use. For me, I really wanted to make sure that the user interface and the user experience was great, because we want people to keep coming back. We wanted the same, interested, really passionate middle schooler who loves history to have the same excitement about the platform as a millennial who's on three different devices versus a stay-at-home, retired grandfather or grandmother who maybe doesn't like technology as much or is a little intimidated by it. We didn't want this platform to intimidate anyone. So what we did is the whole thing's a game. There are 10 levels. You start off as Wayfinder, Pathfinder, Trailblazer. Of course, level 10 is Space Archaeologist. You need to look at, I think it's up to 50,000 tiles, but we have a number of space archaeologists all over the world. And as you can see, what you're doing, so you start off mapping looting, then you map illegal site construction, you move to discovery, you see how many tiles you've looked at, and you may go, well, that's all well and good, but like, how do you know you're good? Right? Like, what if you get on? What if there are mean people who get on and try to mess things up for everyone else? Well, hopefully the internet, it can be an interesting place. I mean, we don't want it to be that bad, but what we've done, we learned working with Digital Globe, who are one of our main partners for this platform, that a minimum of 6 people need to look at one image, and at least 5 out of the 6 need to agree on what that image is before it's either a yes or a no. So you kind of have a fail-safe system. Even if you have a meanie going on and going no when it's yes and yes when it's no, the reality is a number of other people need to agree on a tile, which are all given out randomly. So you can see, just like in Egypt, this is looting at a big site in Peru, and it looks just like Egypt. Looting is the same all over the world. So you sign on the platform, you take a really fun interactive training video, and within 5 minutes, you're looking at images. This is what we wanted. We wanted people to get on the platform, to learn, and to jump right in. And I'll say, if there are any teachers or educators in the audience, we have a Global Explorer education portal. We've had hundreds and hundreds of schools that have used the platform from all over the world. We welcome you to get on. We've had classrooms do it. There's a lot of resources we'd be very, very happy to share with you. This is what it looks like. So you also may be wondering, okay, you have this thing built in where people have to agree with you, and that's fine, but like, aren't you just creating maps for looters? Kind of an interesting question. Well, let me ask you, where's the GPS coordinates? Where's the maps? Where are you in Peru right now? So you see here, it's pretty straightforward. You have a 300 by 300 meter image. You have a small area inside, and you're marking there's looting or no looting. And by the way, you've taken tutorials, so you know what looting looks like. Is there a site? Isn't there a site? You're looking, you have tons of examples of what looks like a site. And you're allowed to mark yes, even if it's a maybe, because it gets kicked to us. So I've had people say, well, what if like hackers went into the website and they reverse engineered with machine learning the image and they were able to like invert it and get it to appear automatically in Google Earth? What would you do then? I'd say Google would hire them for $300,000 a year because they're like geniuses. That's amazing. We've thought this through pretty carefully. We're very careful. We only share the data. We get the data on the back end. It only ever goes to the ministries of culture or archaeological professionals. It never, ever, ever goes in the hands of anyone else. So how easy then are sites to find? You have blobby lines. They're ambiguous. They're not. So this is one major fort site. It's an Inca fort site. It's in northern Peru. It's pretty easy to find, pretty direct. Now, obviously, not every site is like this. There's a range of sites and types, but our users have been pretty successful. I'll share that in a couple minutes. We also partnered with National Geographic. They provided rich content. So what we wanted to do is really give back to our users. So it just wasn't about them coming on the site and finding things, but it was about sharing information about the rich history and cultures of Peru with them. So as they're getting better and better at using the platform, they're able to learn more and more and unlock information. Well, I know what you're all wondering. Did this even work? And by the way, when we launched this platform, I had moments where I went, I'm bonkers. This is crazy. What am I doing thinking that I can, you know, we can teach the world how to be space archaeologists? Can they really find sites? And if they can find sites, are they going to be real sites? And if they're real sites, are they actually going to help archaeologists in the field? What was I thinking? And are people going to use it? Well, to date, we've had 84,000 users from over 100 countries. To date, they have found almost 30,000 potential archaeological features. Thank you. We've had users from nearly every country in the world. We're missing Greenland, and we're missing North Korea. So if any of you have any connections to Kim Jong-un, can you give the platform to Dennis Rodman the next time he goes to hang out with them? That would be awesome. Maybe not, but you know. But you know, for us, this is amazing. We have communities of people from around the world. Every time we did a Google Hangout or a chat, we had someone from Iceland was talking to someone in India who was talking to someone from South Africa, and all of them were bonding over this shared experience and excitement around discovering archaeological sites. The first chat that I had, I admit, being a woman on the internet, I thought, this is not going to go well. 50 random strangers from around the world on an online chat room where pictures can be shared. What was I thinking? I definitely had a lot of what was I thinking moments. I couldn't have been more wrong. Immediately, where are you from? Oh my gosh, this is where I'm from. Hey, have you been to this museum? Hey, I've been there. Hey, you know, I'm gonna post this image. What do you think of this image? What is this thing in this image? And what do you think? And that just this completely organic, unplanned, amazing moment of connection and humanity happened over the fact that everyone was so excited that they didn't just get to hang out with an archaeologist, but they were collecting around this shared purpose and mission of discovery. And I thought, this is kind of what a dig feels like. This is exactly what a dig feels like. You know, people get into conversations on our platforms, on Facebook, people email each other. We've had meetups in Birmingham. People who've used the platform have met up around the world. So we've created this community of like-minded, passionate explorers from around the world. So I said to you at the start, though we created the platform, you know, for people between 5 and 105. And you're like, yeah, 105. Well, meet Doris May Jones. Doris is 92 years old. She lives in Cleveland, Ohio. She's amazing. Of course, she's a space archaeologist. I mean, she's probably found more sites than I have at this point. And I've had the chance to Skype with Doris, and we sometimes chat online. And see, she stays at home. She has a disability. She can't really get out very much. But she told us that for her, the platform was a way to really feel like she had a purpose again. She had an amazing and rich career before her husband died, her kids have moved away, but it just allowed her to feel like she was giving back to the world in an incredibly meaningful way. It wasn't some silly online game, it was something that had real implications. So I also said to you, well, did the platform work? Did it help archaeologists find things? And we collaborated with this amazing archaeologist, Dr. Luis Jaime Castellos, who's a former Vice Minister of Culture in Peru. And our team found, our team being a team of 84,000 people, our amazing community of archaeologists identified many, many hundreds of potential features in the Nazca region where you have these amazing desert geoglyphs. And so we sent, we worked with Luis Jaime, and he went out with his team to map some of these geoglyphs and some of these sites. And via association, he was able to do drone mapping and found 50 previously unknown Nazca lines. So for me, this is, again, what we aim to do. We want to use our data to empower the world, to empower the crowd, and empower archaeologists on the ground, who are really the experts in these ministries of culture and archaeology and at museums around the world. We want to give them the data and say, it's your data. You do with it what you think best. So I am so excited to share with you tonight that next we are going to India. So I can't, I'm just so excited. My team is actually in India right now meeting with the meeting with our partners, the Tata Trust, the Archaeological Survey. And to me, India, I mean, it's massive. It's the size of a continent. You have thousands and thousands of years there of such rich history. And I think we're going to end up finding so many thousands upon thousands of archaeological sites. This is from the very famous site, or UNESCO World Heritage Site of Hampi. And you have many hundreds of these known sites, but to me, India, the world just doesn't know enough about it, and we are so, so excited to be able to go there next. So we'll be relaunching our platform later in the year, and we're going to have so many more educational initiatives. We're going to be working with communities near sites. We're so excited to go there next. And of course, our goal over the next 10 years is to map the world. So No small ambition. We're going to be doing machine learning. I always end up getting machine learning questions. And the idea right now, you know, when you look at the platform, when you look at images, sometimes it's every 20 tiles, sometimes it's every 50, sometimes it's every 100. Welcome to my world. A lot of the work I do, you look at imagery and you don't find anything. This is science. Science is hard. But with machine learning, we can get rid of the bad tiles. We can really help prioritize what tiles the crowd votes on. So slight moment of shameless self-promotion. If you liked what you heard tonight, my book, Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past, is coming out July 9th with Henry Holt. It's available for pre-order on Amazon. And I have to go back a bit because I want to read. Unfortunately, it got cut off. But one of my book blurbers I mentioned to you, I like Lord of the Rings. I was very honored that Sir Peter Jackson blurbed my book. And it's such a gift to be able to give him back some of the stories that he shared with me. So anyway, I please invite you to order the book. I really can't wait for it to come out and be shared with the world. So kind of going back to what I said at the start. You know, there's so much at stake right now for us. There's so much nervousness in the world. I think what we're seeing more than anything else is a lack of hope. Everyone's scared about climate change. Everyone's scared about political upheaval and changes and tensions. No matter where you are in the world, no matter what your political beliefs are, there's so much uncertainty about our future. And I think what things like Global Explorer, what archaeology helps us to do, it gives us some perspective. It shows us that so many groups of people who've come before us, so many civilizations, have dealt with these issues. Now, sometimes it hasn't gone well. Sometimes civilizations have collapsed. And yet we've persevered. We keep persevering. We keep evolving. We keep moving on. And for me, as a mother, I have to be optimistic for my son and for my students at my university. And I think what archaeology ultimately shows us and helps us to see is our resilience, our creativity, what we do in the face of seemingly insurmountable challenges. And ultimately, and more than anything else, archaeology shows us our common humanity, and that no matter your faith, your political beliefs, your background, your culture, where you've come from, your families, ultimately we're all part of a great human family. And yeah, we may fight sometimes over Thanksgiving dinner, but ultimately we're all here on this third rock from the sun. We've been here for 300,000 years, and I think by understanding archaeology and by understanding all that we could achieve, we'll be here for another 300,000. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah. We have two microphones, one here and one here. We are going to take about 10 minutes for questions, and so I invite you to come up, and Sarah will answer your questions.
Hi, my name is Ellen Morrow. So first, I just wanted to say, TDO1, I'm happy to see you. but my second question is about your relationship to academia throughout this process and how it's helped you and what you've learned from it, and then what you think you've given back and what you've needed to be in the private sector to do.
Sure. So great, it's great. It's been a few years. It's great to see you again. So I think, yeah, I mean, I'm a full professor at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And there, you know, I think anytime you do any kind of public outreach work, there's a tension between that and academia. So being a woman, being a scientist, being in academia, you to get tenure, UAB is the Carnegie Research Institute in the state of Alabama. There are very strict rules and regulations around tenure and promotion. You have to write, X number of articles. You have to get funding. I've been funded by the National Science Foundation, by NASA, obviously National Geographic, private donors. You have to mentor students. You have to teach. I teach a normal course load. So, I didn't start doing as much public outreach work until I got tenure. That's the general advice I give to my more junior colleagues, if you want to go more into public outreach, tenure is really important. And I think the ivory tower has to change. I gave a big lecture at the Archaeological Institute of America. That's a big archaeology conference in earlier this year, and I talked about the need and the necessity for public archaeology and outreach. The reality is, we're seeing with all the fake news online, and I hate to say ancient aliens, but ancient aliens, there's so much stuff that's not true, right? Like, we made the pyramids. You go to the Maya exhibit at the museum. The Maya were extraordinary. There were no aliens. This was us. If you can make an iPhone, you can make a pyramid. which is the example I use. So I think it's more important now than ever that people in my field and in academia generally do public outreach. So I think the ivory tower has to maybe open its doors a little bit more, and kind of more broadly, we need more diversity. We need more diversity and exploration, which is why I started Global Explorer. So yeah, it's hard. It's a delicate line to walk. I very much appreciate being, university is a great address to have. I couldn't do what I do without being a professor. But it's not always easy. It's not always easy when you want to do public outreach.
What's your favorite specimen that you have collected over the years?
Ooh, that is a great question. My favorite thing that I have been able to find over the years, there have been so many things. So my first season working in Egypt, I was very lucky to find, so this was back 20 years ago, and I was very lucky to find a pot. It was an offering jar that was left at a cemetery at a 4,200-year-old site. It was squished flat, but as I was excavating it, and it was intact, I found a thumbprint on it. And it was a really fat thumbprint, and I had this moment, it was my first season working in Egypt, of kind of being transported back in time and trying to imagine who made the thumbprint. And the person behind it, because ultimately we dig for people, not things, right? So it just taught me that archaeology is kind of a gigantic empathy machine, right? We're always putting ourselves in the positions and in the places of the people that built these amazing monuments, that made these beautiful objects. So I was very fortunate in my first season to get this really important lesson about why we do what we do. It's to learn about people in the past.
Thank you very much. Could you explain a little bit about what your technology is actually detecting? I'm guessing that it's interfaces of different densities or something like that. And then what are the implications of that for helping us understand Anasazi Fremont culture where there's not roads?
Right. So when satellites record information, they snap pictures in different parts of the light spectrum. So we, of course, can only see in the visible part, but the light spectrum extends far beyond to the near, middle, far infrared, thermal infrared. So think of satellites kind of like giving you a space-based x-ray. They allow you to see these subtle differences in these layers of the Earth. And if you have a buried archaeological feature, whether it's a road or a pyramid base or an entire settlement, as you saw, what happens is the overlaying vegetation and soils and grass and sand is affected a little bit by what's buried beneath. You know, the mud brick will degrade, the stone will degrade, and this is stuff you can't typically see in the visible part of the light spectrum. So you process it in different parts of the light spectrum that you can't see. I use off-the-shelf software, and it shows up. So it makes this invisible world completely visible to us. And we do a lot of imagery manipulation. I use a lot of standard processing algorithms. And the software and the technologies that I use are used by biologists to find, you know, different types of ecosystems or potential disease vectors in Central and South America. They're used by climatologists to study changes in ice sheets. They're used by urban by people who study urbanization to look at how cities change over time. So they're used by many, many different people, but ultimately it's looking at these subtle differences in the light spectrum to try to discover what's buried beneath the ground.
Hi, I'm just wondering, based on that wonderful map you showed from Mr. Trebek, how do you decide what site to study with your team based on how many things you look at on a daily basis, I'm sure? And then based on that, have you ever had problems with governments not letting you in, and how do you combat that issue?
Great question. So whenever we work in a particular place, so obviously in Egypt, I work at Lish, it's a close collaboration with the ministry. I'm able to go back year after year because of my close collaboration with them. I'm in constant contact with my Egyptian colleagues. I'm on the phone once a week with my rais. So for me, it's not about the work permit, it's about the relationships. And I feel that that's my approach everywhere I go in the world. If I'm lucky enough to be invited to another country to work, I work on establishing relationships first, because that's going to form the foundation of all future collaborations. You know, this has taken me a long time to learn. And if nothing ever happens, well, maybe not now, but in 5 years, the relationships I've developed with these amazing people, you know, you never know what could happen. So we work, as I said, very closely with foreign governments. Ultimately, you know, they are the ones telling us what they need. So with Global Explorer in India, the government has said, right, we are very interested in mapping these particular sites in these particular places. We go, okay, great, we'll set the platform up to map those places. It's a need you've identified to us. We're serving you. We're not there for any other reason. So we're very careful wherever we go. We get buy-in from museum directors, archaeologists, curators. We develop close collaborations with professors at universities. So we take direction from local experts. We basically go in with a menu of offerings and say, what would you like? This is what we can do. And they say, well, we want something that's not on your menu. We go, well, that's interesting. We hadn't thought of that. So we end up doing something else that we hadn't thought of, which to me is really exciting. So yeah, whenever we choose to dig, so we... obviously work in Egypt, but if a team wants to excavate based on the data that we've shared, great, that's what we want, right? So we're not choosing where to dig, we're just giving them great data, and they're gonna be the ones that make the decisions. And you always face challenges, no matter where you work in the world. It doesn't matter whether you're dealing with any of our governments or a government anywhere in the world. Governments are challenging, and you just have to negotiate complex political situations. Ultimately, it's about relationships and partnerships and building out those first.
How old were you when you wanted to be a scientist?
How old was I? I think I was younger than you. One of my first memories is the Tooth Fairy bringing me an amazing book about ancient Egypt when I lost my first tooth. So I think I was 5, 6 years old when that happened. My mom told me, aka the Tooth Fairy, she said, "You're talking about Egypt, and like that's bonkers. You're from Bangor, Maine. Like there's no mummies in Bangor, Maine. There are moose, and there's no sand. There's snow, and yet you were interested in Egypt." So I was very lucky that my parents encouraged me. So I've known I wanted to study Egypt ever since I was a very, very little girl. I didn't know that I would be a scientist, though. I didn't think at the time of Egyptology and archaeology being science, because these were in the days pre-cable and pre-internet, aka 100 years ago. But really, you're so lucky now. You're so lucky. You have all these amazing videos and shows and content where you can learn. And what I would say to you and to all the young students that are in the room, when I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and even going into university, I didn't know that you could be someone who specialized in the application of satellite imagery to find ancient archaeological sites. What I ultimately ended up doing didn't really exist when I went to school. So whatever you want to do, or you or any of you here, I promise you it doesn't exist yet. So I would encourage you to go and invent it.
Do you find any dinosaurs with the technology?
I love dinosaur questions. So randomly, like this is so crazy, it doesn't sound like it's true, but that's my life. We actually found a dinosaur in one season, completely by accident. We were working along the west coast of Sinai at an Old Kingdom fort site, so 4,300 years ago. We were doing the survey and mapping work in the wadis, so paths that were leading up through the mountains. And we had a geologist with us, and he came over and was like, "You won't believe what I found. It's a dinosaur." Like, "Larry, what?" And it was a dinosaur. It was a mesosaur, I think. My six-year-old knows dinosaurs way more than me, so apologies to any dinosaur enthusiasts in the room. But because the whole of Sinai is this massive limestone sandstone system that used to be at the bottom of the ocean, there are amazing dinosaurs that are there. So randomly we found one, we turned over the information to the ministry. But what you can do, and what I would love to see the technology used for, so as you know, you find deposits of dinosaurs and dinosaur bones in specific geological strata. And what happens is it's really, really hard to find those little lenses. Sometimes you have to be out. So many dinosaur discoveries have been made by accident. That's what my paleontology friends tell me. And so what you can use the satellites for is all these different types of stone appear differently in different parts of the light spectrum. So you can use the satellite technology to find different geological lenses, and then you can go out and do the same survey work that we do in Egypt, but instead of digging up a town, you can hopefully find dinosaurs. So I'm going to challenge you to do that. I hope to read about your work soon. Yes?
I'm in fourth grade, and I wondered how I could get my class onto, like, Global Explorer.
Okay, it's really easy. Just go, and every school is different. Some schools have in-class, whether you have iPads, whether you have a computer resource center or a library, or you each have individual laptops, all you need to do is go to globalexplorer.org and sign up. It's as simple as that. And I will say, as we redevelop the platform later this fall, we're going to have a kind of a sign-in widget for classrooms, because what we really, really want to do, one of the things I wanted to do when I launched the platform, I want to have students here in Salt Lake City competing against classrooms in Mumbai who are competing against classrooms in London, and everyone is competing to try to find the most sites, because why not? It'd be awesome. So yeah, by the fall for sure, but you can sign up now.
So I'm a freshman at Weber in Ogden, and I was wondering, how do you prioritize between, first of all, I know you travel a lot, how do you prioritize between where you're going and how long you're with family and how long you're gone from family, how long you're home, and especially with teaching?
Right. That's a great question. It's hard. It's really, really, really hard being a woman in science and being a woman who has a child. It was really tough the first couple years of our son's life when babies are little. Like, there's a biological reality to that generally. So I didn't travel as much the first year he was around. Started traveling a little bit more each year. I travel a lot. And what I tell all younger folks about time, don't think of it as a balance. There's no such thing as balance. Balance means that things are still. We all know that nothing is ever still. There's always something. Think of it as a pendulum, because a pendulum's always moving. And what you want to make sure you do in your life, sometimes the pendulum's going to go fast, sometimes it's going to go real slow, and you're going to wonder, is that pendulum ever going to move again? But you want to be able to predict the pendulum. So you want to be able to set your life up so that you can predict when it's going to move fast and when it's going to move slow. Sometimes you can't. That's reality. But it's hard. It's hard. None of us have it figured out. If anyone ever tells you they have it figured out, they're lying. You know, we just all are muddling and mucking through and doing our best. You know, my son knows that I travel. My son knows that more often than not, if he's been good, there's a treat waiting for him in my bag. It's taught me to appreciate my family quite a bit. You know, it's a juggle. You know, we're always managing childcare, and there's always something that comes up, but it's just hard. It's hard. I say no to most things. I have to. It's, you know, my family comes first. But you know, then sometimes I get to travel to amazing places like Salt Lake City and be in front of an incredible audience like you. So, you know, it's fun too. My family understands. A lot of the time they'll come with me. So yeah, no matter what, it's hard. And I still haven't figured it out.
I love the title of your talk, by the way. Main reason why I came. I thought it was really cool. But I'm very interested in learning about what you do on the field, not necessarily looking at the satellite images themselves, but more excavating. Right. What tools do you use? What types of cameras? Things like that.
Right. So when you saw the images from Egypt, so in Egypt, it's the law that you have to hire local labor to do the excavation. So we do a lot of the fine work, so we're using trowels and hose to just gently scrape away. If there's a change in the level or the layers, you know, we direct our team to dig. But excuse me, we're recording everything in very detailed form. So each individual layer that we dig through, think of it like a 3D time capsule. And every one of those 3D time capsules has a very detailed page. We're recording information about soil type, soil color, inclusions. Is it wet? Is it clay? How much pottery is there? What objects are there? We're doing constant 3D drawings of everything we're finding. We're doing detailed top plans, so we're plotting everything we find as we go down and go down and go down. You know, a lot of digging, it's manual labor. You're literally removing dirt from the ground. But as we're going along, we're taking thousands and thousands of pictures of everything. We want to record everything in situ. That means it in its original spot. I'm the director, so unfortunately, I don't get to dig very much anymore. But it's nice being a woman in charge of 100 men. So I work with an amazing group of people. I'm very lucky to do that. But yeah, it's a lot of juggling too. So as the dig director, I'm managing my team. I'm making sure that my team has all the supplies that they need. I'm managing everyone's safety. As I said before, the safety of my Egyptian and foreign staff is paramount. I don't want any of my team taking risks. You know, if my workmen are working in a tomb shaft, they have to be wearing masks and a helmet and safe shoes. No, there's no excuses. I don't want anyone to get hurt. I'm worried that there's good food. An army marches on its stomach, so does an excavation team. So everyone, if you don't have good coffee on a site, watch out. There will be people murdered. That's a priority. Half my bag is usually good coffee when I travel. I'm dealing with the finances. I'm responsible for managing the budget. I'm the one that's gotten the grant. I'm responsible to the National Science Foundation or the NEH. I've told them I'm going to go into the field and do X, Y, and Z. And sometimes you can only do X. And sometimes you try to do Y and it's a fail and Z is no go. So then why? I'm responsible for the money, and it's government money. It's thank you very much, taxpayers. It comes from you. I'm accountable to you. So it's my job to be responsible with the money that the government has given to me. So managing all these things all at once. Okay?
You use units when you dig.
Units. Yeah, so it depends. We adapt our excavation units or trenches depending on the site. So sometimes we'll subdivide, and you can always collapse together, but you can never pull apart. So we tend to be a little more conservative when we're excavating. So it may be, like in the hall that you saw of the Tomb of Entef, it's all one big layer, but we may subdivide into separate trenches just to kind of keep ourselves honest. But you have to be so careful. And meanwhile, I'm circling around, making sure everyone, I have teams that are in charge of excavation, and making sure everyone's drinking enough water because it's hot. And then on top of that, I typically have members of the government that are coming and visiting, and I better be on call when they're coming. But it's the best job in the world. I wouldn't trade it for anything else. Thank you.